Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Falter Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots. Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Bruno Kreisky Forum und im Podcast Falter Radio. Mein Name ist Raimund Löw und ich habe die Ehre, heute durch diese Sendung zu führen, die uns nach Moskau führt, in die russische Hauptstadt. Es ist ein knappes Jahr her, dass Russland seinen Angriff gegen die Ukraine begonnen hat. Der Krieg seit dem 24. Februar 2022 hat verheerende Veränderungen in der Ukraine angerichtet, verheerende Verwüstungen, Zehntausende Soldaten und Zivilisten sind umgekommen und die geopolitische Situation für ganz Europa hat sich verändert. Auch Russland hat sich verändert durch diesen Krieg, den der russische Präsident Putin vom Zaun gebrochen hat. Darüber spreche ich heute mit einem hochrangigen Experten direkt in Moskau und dieses Gespräch werden wir auf Englisch führen. It's the time to switch to English. A warm welcome to Andrei Kolesnikov in Moscow. Hello, Andrei.
Hello, good to see you.
We are glad and we are honored to be able to talk to you from the Bruno Kreisky Forum in Vienna as well as from podcast Falter Radio. Andrei Kolesnikov is Senior Fellow and Chair of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's an international American think tank with many offices in different parts of the world and also in Moscow. Andrei Kolesnikov has written several books related to the political and ideological shifts in Russia. He's also a journalist, a colleague. So to say, he was managing director of Novaya Gazeta. And Novaya Gazeta was a leading democratic newspaper for many years. Now, it stopped publication last year in Russia. In this, there is still Novaya Gazeta Europe coming out of Latvia. Andrei, I hope we will be able to touch many aspects of the situation in Russia. Our title we have chosen is The Mood of the People and the Behavior of the Elites. But to start, what for you is the most dramatic element of change in Russia that the people of Russia have experienced this last year?
Yeah, that's a very good question, such an existential one, such a fashionable word here, existential. Everything is existential right now. And really, it was a big change in everything, in the perception of reality, in the behavior of people, in expressing opinions, expressing themselves, in the behavior of the authorities. Despite the fact that we lived for many years in an authoritarian state, despite this fact, it was kind of a red line, kind of a new stage, new period of the life of this regime after the February 24, 2022. It became more cruel and became more sincere, let's say, without any kind of desire to hear anyone in this society. Putin became a real autocrat. I would say that right now we have even some elements of the totalitarian state. So many denunciations in the behavior of people who are supporting the war, for instance. So many obligations for teachers in school, for instance. I mean, a special lesson for children talking about something important. The important is for sure propaganda, cliches, etc., etc. And this is a bit another society, which is more obedient, which is ready to accept different propaganda cliches from the very top, from television primarily. And people are trying to justify, I mean, the majority of people, not all Russian people, the majority wants to justify the actions of top authorities, to justify the special operation, the cruelty. This is a psychological, let's say, block for them, how to avoid moral responsibility. And, you know, sometimes when I'm exchanging notes with my colleagues, we're referring to the psychological and another experience of the Nazi Germany, because when we're reading books about everyday life in Germany in 1930s, we see to some extent ourselves, how we're trying to adapt to the situation. So this is maybe the main change and very sad change.
You're now in your home office in Moscow, is that correct, physically, for viewers to understand where you are?
Yes, I am physically in Moscow. There was a Carnegie Moscow Center, which has been liquidated in April. We lost our office, and this word chair in my credentials, this is not the right word, because I am not a chair of a former program of Russian domestic politics. Right now, I'm simply a senior fellow who works directly with our headquarters in Washington.
And you have been labeled a foreign agent, is that correct, by the authorities? How did that happen? What kind of consequences did that have?
Yeah, that's right. I've been labeled in the end of December. There are 500 of us, I mean, including organizations, including journalists, including politicians, sometimes think tankers like me. This is a very unpleasant status with a lot of responsibilities, accountancy, recording of your actions, incoming money, expenditures, etc., etc. It is humiliating, like kind of a yellow star or something. You must label yourself in your social media, and media who are publishing you, Russian media, I mean, they have to make kind of a special plaque that you are a foreign agent. So it's extremely unpleasant, and it creates, to some extent, more risks, political risks.
But you can publish articles in the Russian media. In how far are you restricted by the legal requirements linked to the war situation in what you say and what you write?
I can publish, yes. I can publish, I can broadcast with this special labeling. But I can't, for instance, be a professor somewhere in universities. It's impossible for me. I can't work with, for instance, as a teacher or, I don't know, organizer of enlightenment events with children. So there are some prohibitions in that sense.
You used the word war here. So we have heard that and read that the Russian authorities didn't allow the war in Ukraine to be called war. It has to be officially called a special military operation. Is that still applied? Is that still implemented? Or do also does Russia as a society realize this is a war, a terrible war with huge destructions and a catastrophe?
Yes, people understand it for sure, and they understand that this is a real cruel war, and propaganda uses this word. If I will use this word, in that case, I could be persecuted, but Putin can use this word, Minister of Foreign Affairs can use this word, everyone from the very top. And, you know, according to the propaganda, here is a new thesis. They say that we are struggling not with Ukraine, not with our brothers. Ukrainians are simply kind of the instruments of this war, with NATO, with the collective West. Our enemy, real enemy, is this very collective West. This is the main thesis right now of our propaganda.
How would you judge the attitude of the population towards the war? We often have this impression where there may be 15% of Russian society is enthusiastically pro-war, maybe 15% percent against, and the rest is somehow between and would follow whatever Putin says and Putin does. Does that reflect the situation according to you, and how did it evolve in these last months?
If you are talking about big figures, the figures of sociologists, this is true. But the amount of people who are definitely supporting this war, it is contracting all the time. For instance, several months ago, the figure was 52%. Right now, it's 41% as for December of 2022. I mean, definitely, there is a big group of people who are rather supporting this war, but they are hesitating. They don't have their own opinion. They prefer to say during focus groups, okay, I'm a small person, maybe Putin knows better, right or wrong, this is my country, etc., etc. All this psychological blocking of bad information and justification of yourself. The standard and stable figure of people who were against Putin, who were against this regime, all those people are against this war. This is around 17, 18, 20% of the population, of respondents, rather to say. And they're very different. But if we'll say about the whole amount of people at the scale of the whole Russia, it means that millions of people are against this war. And maybe they are not protesting openly. It's very dangerous for people right now in Russia. But mute resistance or expressing themselves in any other way, this is also very important. And here is the fact of the accumulation of discontent with Putin in this very group of people.
We have seen last fall when there was the mobilization coming from the government. A lot of young people left the country because they didn't want to go to war. There were also some protests against in the streets, rather significant protests in the streets. What's left from this signs of civil society? Is the civil society sort of exist under these conditions in Russia?
Yes, the civil society is still here. And if we'll take the statistics of the persecution of people on the ground, of discreditation of the army, fakes about this war, you will see that there are thousands of people who are persecuted on the ground of the administrative law or even on the ground of criminal law. There are some people who are persecuted criminally, and for instance, some leaders of the former opposition are imprisoned, and they have very long, very serious sentences, around 7 or 8 years, just like in Stalinist era. In that sense, we can say that people are not resisting. I'm very skeptical about measuring the protest feelings by people who are in the streets. It is strongly prohibited. We are living in a strongly authoritarian regime, and people can go to the streets without consequences. Sometimes in the West, people can't understand it. But the resistance is here, and people are trying to find compassion between each other, staying here in Russia. But really, a lot of people preferred to leave Russia in order to continue their work, if they are journalists primarily. And it's also important because they are broadcasting to this very audience, domestic audience, not for the audience somewhere abroad. Their function is extremely important. I mean, all those people who left the country and who are continuing to work as journalists primarily. It's dangerous to be here for people of these professions, but some of them, even in the status of foreign agents like me, we're trying to stay here in order to research, in order to understand from inside what is happening, in order to broadcast, to write, to explain until the last red line for us, maybe.
There are these important Russian media out of the Baltics, out of Latvia and other countries like TV Dosh, TV Rain, or Medusa, all not official state media have never been official state media in Russia, where independent media now broadcast from outside of Russia. Are they followed? Do they have a real audience? Can people follow what Medusa is writing every day and what Dosht is airing? Is that possible?
Yes, they are all blocked here, officially and physically. But people who want to hear alternative information and write alternative opinions, they have this opportunity using VPN. A lot of people right now are using VPN. And at the same time, YouTube is not blocked until now because millions and millions of Russians are using it. And Kremlin also uses it sometimes. And because of that, they don't want to prohibit it totally. And this is one of the main sources of the information and opinions for Russian domestic audience. People are broadcasting via YouTube from abroad, from Riga, from Amsterdam, from Warsaw, etc., etc. And these YouTube channels are very, very popular among Russians here.
One of the most well-known opposition activists and now political prisoner of Russia is Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption activist who had been poisoned and then came back and is in a prison camp a couple of hundred kilometers outside of Moscow. And he seems to be in big danger. His health seems to be in danger, but he is airing anti-war positions in a very strong and clear way, despite the fact that he had been close to some Russian nationalists before. How significant is this stance of Alexei Navalny, and how is he really in danger now?
Yes, he's really in danger, and I would say that this is a real problem, and he's a real hero in that sense. He's consciously resisting, he's trying to survive. To say the truth, they're trying to kill him. They poisoned him and he survived, and they punished him for the survival. Yes, he had very contradictory vision of the world many years ago, but I followed his evolution, political evolution. Now he is really a pure liberal and pure democratic politician, not to mention that his team is extremely efficient. They're continuing his work. But at the same time, for sure, when he was free, when he was an organizer of meetings and different events in the streets, etc., etc., he was more visible. He was more popular. Now he don't have such an opportunity to be vocal, to be visible, and
of course, because he's in a cell, imprisoned in a cell, and he can communicate through his lawyers, right? They can meet him, and they give tweet on tweets and social media. They give his opinions, transmit it to the public.
Yes, he does it, just like Ilya Yashin and Vladimir Karamurza. They also do it. I don't know the technology, but they can do it. But again, he lost a part of his audience. Because of this fact of not being so vocal, and not to mention that the mood of the population is gloomy. They do not pay so much attention to the corruption issues, to the issues of how all those people, all those decision makers are making policy right now. Many people are justifying this behavior as something new normal. So we are at war with the whole world. And in that case, we have to support our government, at least right now. This is one of the possible positions.
We are speaking to Andrei Kolesnikov in Moscow in this edition of the emission of Kreisky Forum and the podcast Falter Radio. I wonder, after all that we have discussed now, there is a discussion in Europe in how far Russia as a society should be considered responsible for this war and for the destructions. Many voices, particularly in the Baltics, also in Poland, would say Russians who may not support actively the war. They are co-responsible because they didn't stop it. What is your reaction to this kind of positions?
I can't agree with it because, again, as I said, millions of people are against it, against this regime. Thousands of them are struggling with the regime or resisting to this or that way. So all those people, they don't have any guilt. They always were against this regime. Who is responsible for it? Our elites, who have got accustomed to live quite good, a part of middle class, who really didn't pay a lot of attention to the political issues, because in big cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, cities with millions of inhabitants, people live quite good, just like in any other European capital.
And they still do. They still do.
To some extent, a bit worse, but they still do, yes. And all those people said, what is democracy for? We are living quite good, especially in Moscow. It was a typical position. Everyone admired Sabanin as a very efficient manager, as a mayor of Moscow. So we had the best restaurants, the best cinema premieres, the best theaters, etc., best salaries. So without any kind of democracy. But it found out if you do not rotate the power, you will have, at the end of the day, this kind of regime and this kind of war, and this kind of leader who smashed all your achievements in the past.
I mean, that's the dramatic contradiction of the situation, of course. In Kiev and the Ukrainian cities, it's destruction, death, and lack of electricity and fear to be targeted by bombings. And in Petersburg and in Moscow, it's more or less normal life goes on. The absurdity of this situation, is that in the consciousness of Russian society present?
Yes, and at least in the milieu, in the community of people who are trying to understand what is happening, who are against this regime, this is a permanent discussion about collective guilt and collective responsibility. I will say more that sometimes we are witnessing quarrels between people who left the country, and they accuse people who are still staying in the country that they are traitors of democracy and they are supporting, in that sense, Putin. But people who are staying here accusing, in their turn, people who left, and people who are staying here are accusing people who are abroad. They say you can't do anything significant from abroad. You must, let's say, help us to survive, to express compassion, etc. But again, when we are talking about collective responsibility, it's really more about the cynical layers of the society who lived quite good and supported this regime. Because this regime gave them this prosperity. The other part of the society, poor people or people with low income, lower middle classes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They are more or less conservative, and they tend to support Putin as their real leader.
This year of military operation, of war, has caused also on the Russian side a lot of casualties, thousands, maybe 10,000, dead thousands of dead soldiers, wounded soldiers. This growing number of casualties, does it have any effect on the attitude of the society towards the war?
Yes, a lot of people are feeling that this is horrible. And the mood is gloomy, and the feeling of anxiety is very high. But The bad thing is that big layers of the population, they decided to support Putin until the end, and there are groups of very aggressive conformists, not simply passive conformists. Oh, this is a trouble, but we have to support our leader because we are at war with the West, etc., etc., etc. But aggressive conformists, they appeal to more cruel war, to the total war in the proper sense of the word. And I would say that morally, part of society really changed their minds, and they are supporting war as war. I can't say what share of the population it is, but at the same time, I know that there are a lot of people who do not feel compassion to people, to empathy to victims of this war. From the other side, from the side of Ukrainians, but from the from our side as well. And they feel kind of they want revenge for victims from the from our side among mobilized people, because the statistics of different losses is quite high, even official statistics. It is really higher than during, for instance, the Afghan war, which was also quite important for national consciousness and undermined the ground.
In the time of the Soviet Union, that was the Brezhnev Politburo who had decided to invade Afghanistan, yes.
But now it's more serious than during the time of the Afghan war, I mean from the point of view of losses.
I think it's very important what you say, that there is a cult of war in parts of the elites, something that... we in Europe, in Germany, experienced, of course, at the beginning of the last century, cult of war. We have these pro-war factions in the leadership, the Wagner Group and the leader of the Wagner Group, Mr. Prigozhin, or also the Kadyrov, the Chechnya leader. They seem to be critical of the military leadership. In your view, are these forces that are instruments of Putin, of the Kremlin, or are they potential competitors with Putin and even adversaries of the Putin leadership, these hardliners?
I think that both options are plausible because, on the one hand, they behave like kind of independent players with their own information policy. They are criticizing official army, etc., etc. But on the other hand, I would say that Putin always tries to control all the elite groups. This is his interest to initiate quarrels between them, to initiate conflicts, but he is an arbiter for them. He is the top person, and they are appealing to him at the end of the day. And I'm sure that Prigozhin is under control. Now he's very useful for Putin and very efficient from his point of view as a supplier of the cannon fodder, to say the truth. And in that sense, he's also very useful for Putin as a person who criticizing official army, and army keeps itself on its toes. In that sense, this is the interest of Putin to balance different clans around him. But again, I don't see any kind of disbalance between these groups. I think Putin can control, and he strengthens his power. He strengthened his image as a strong leader because of this war.
You mentioned Afghanistan, and in the time of the Afghanistan invasion, it was pretty clear. There was a Politburo of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The Politburo had to decide, yes, we invade, or no, we don't invade. It was clear who takes decisions. What do we know now? When, in case there is an escalation or the opposite, who would decide that? Who would decide what at the end Putin is doing in the Kremlin?
On the one hand, this is a strongly personalistic system, as always in the Russian and Soviet history. But I would say that even in times of Politburo, there was kind of a collective ruling of the country. Right now, the weight of the first person is more significant than in Soviet times. At the same time, he has very strong, small group of Obeid supporters, like Patrushev, for instance, who plays the role of the main ideologue of this group. Bortnikov is the head of FSB, for sure the bosses of the army, and some more people. And they have, this is not simply Soviet or old-fashioned consciousness. In the center of their ideology, the idea of empire is the main point, is the cornerstone, the idea of the glorious past. They reject Soviet Marxist ideology. They are more about Russian nationalism and Russian imperialism and Russian history in their personal interpretation. This is what important for them. And I think these people can make this decision. Yes, Kovalchuki brothers as well, who were, as some people say, the initiators of this campaign. So very narrow group of people. But the main question is how elite, which is more or less modernized, obeyed so lightly to these horrible people.
There have been in the last days even changes in the military leadership of this campaign. Rather abrupt changes. Now it's the chief of staff, Gerasimov, who is now also responsible for what's going on in the war. Do these frequent changes, do they have a political meaning? Is that a sign of lack of stability, or is it just the military logic that is decisive?
I think this is a sign of anxiety at the very top, how to make this military action is more efficient, on the one hand. On the other hand, this is the same logic of balancing different groups around Putin. If Prigozhin is too strong, you must strengthen another part of this possible conflict. I mean, official army generals like Gerasimov. At the same time, maybe Putin really thinks that Gerasimov could be efficient as a person who can change something as a battlefield. So different reasons, all of them are workable. But again, this is really a sign of different anxieties at the very top.
If we talk about the elites in Russia, we have to talk, of course, of the top economic elite too, the oligarchs, often mentioned also quite often under sanctions now from the European Union, from the Americans. Do these oligarchs have any means of influence really on the political leadership, or is this a completely different body of economic power only?
They themselves say that they don't have any influence on Putin. They can't do anything. They couldn't prevent this war, despite the fact that they really tried to explain some economic consequences to him, not quarreling with him for sure, not leaving their places. Whether we are talking about oligarchs as businessmen who are quite close to the state, or about people who are working in the economic block of the government and were considered as liberals. They're not liberals right now for sure, they're simply technocrats who are liquidating the worstest consequences of the special operation. And you know, some experts in our community, they name people from the government like Nabiullin as the head of Central Bank, like Sulanov, the head of Ministry of Finances, all of them very efficient as professionals. We name them a collective Yalmar Schacht. Because
who has been the top economic person of Hitler.
Yeah, in 1930s. So in that sense, it is understandable that part of responsibility, it is on them. They have to understand it, and they understand it, but they are obediently continue to work with kind of an explanation. We're working not for Putin, but for people of Russia in order to survive this hard period of time.
You mentioned the fact that the Russian leadership describes this war as a war against NATO, the West, the collective West. So after 1 year of war, is it clear for you what are the aims of the Putin leadership? Is this a if you are at war with NATO, probably with the aim of the war cannot be to have Russia get into London or Paris the way Soviet troops moved into Berlin in 45. What are the war aims? Is it control of Ukraine, control of a part of Ukraine, a rollback of all the consequences of the democratic revolutions of 89? Is that clear to you?
Paradoxically, despite the fact that Putin suggested several explanations, denazification, demilitarization, uniting Russian nation as well, returning and strengthening our territories, he mentioned Peter the Great as an example for his behavior. But at the end of the day, to say the truth, it is ununderstandable. This is a problem of this regime, the problem of goal setting and such. It was understandable several years ago that we're trying to modernize this country to make it a normal, let's say, capitalist state with some elements of the authoritarianism, nationalism, but at the same time, more or less normal state. But what is the goal right now? It's ununderstandable. And the war is the goal as such. So this is the philosophy, the ideology, and the mission of Putin to continue the war. We're saying Putin, we mean war, Alice. So, but philosophically, in the sense of a mission, maybe he wants to restore Russian Empire as he sees it.
Is in this framework, in what could the role of possible negotiations be, if that's the mindset of the leadership? As you know, particularly in Germany, we have quite some voices of people who say, well, there is a lack of offers for negotiations from NATO and from the West, and that's one of the reasons of this war going on. Is there any place for negotiations in the mindset of Russian leadership today?
I can't see any signs of readiness of good faith from Putin's side. He's not ready to negotiate. Yes, he wants negotiations because there are voices in the society and more voices for peace talks. But at the same time, he wants his talks only on his own terms. It is unacceptable for the Ukrainian side. When Putin initiated these referendums on the occupied territories, it became obvious that he's blocking the very possibility of any realistic agenda for any peace talks. So no entrance into any kind of peace talks. This is a problem. Maybe some negotiations on the basis of discussing nuclear issues with the American side, with Westerners, it is a possible option. But Russian side refused even to talk with Americans in Cairo last year in December. They wanted to talk about strategic weaponry, but Russian side decided not to go to Cairo at the last moment. It means they are not ready to talk. And this is one of the main problems of this very conflict, this unreadiness to negotiate.
There are differences how to approach the situation between Germans and French on the one side and the Americans and the Brits and Poles on the other side. And one of the arguments that probably would come from a French and German government position, and probably when we have Macron who speaks to Putin and we have Scholz who speaks to Putin, I guess there is a logic behind that. One of the ideas is that if the West proposes an offer to Russia for a stable post-war situation for Russia and ceasefire, and maybe kind of a neutral status for Ukraine. Would that make any difference as far as the war-like attitude of the Russian leadership is concerned?
No, I don't think so. I can't say that there is a kind of a realistic offer from the Western side which is acceptable, which could be acceptable for Putin, because here is one more side of negotiations. Ukraine is such, and Ukraine and Zelensky, they have their own position, and they want another kind of peace talks. They want the returning, this is just a suggestion, they want the returning to the borders of 1991. So it's understandable, but also unrealistic. And this is a kind of an impasse in that sense. Yes, and I would say that one of the important parts of the possible negotiations or influencing Putin could be China or India, for instance. If they will take seriously these dramatic events as a threat to the world as such, maybe they can influence Putin. Maybe they don't want to spoil the relations with Putin, but at the same time, they could be more significant for Putin himself as Western countries.
Let me come back to the characterization of the Putin regime nowadays in this war situation after 1 year of war. The discussion is this fascism. You mentioned you feel like you like it's like Germany in the 30s. Would you say that Russia is now became a fascist regime, the Putin regime?
No, I'd rather say that this is ultra-conservative, authoritarian, personalistic dictatorship with the ideology of imperialism, resentment, and nationalism. With a big role of the state in the economy as well. This is also the part of this ideology. I can't say that this is a pure definition of fascism or Nazism. There are very different faces of this phenomenon of conservative authoritarian regimes. So in that sense, I'd rather use this more neutral term, like authoritarian personalistic dictatorship.
If war is has such an important place in the ideology of the leadership, does that mean Putin is preparing Russian society for several years of war? We are now 1 year into the war with Ukraine. Is Putin preparing Russia for 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years of war going on the way it's going on now?
It looks like that he wants a victory, but he can't describe what does it mean, this victory. And people are ready to accept the idea that this war could be procrastinated, prolonged. But at the same time, Putin will have presidential elections, and I can't exclude that he will not liquidate the institution of elections. He will try.
These are supposed to be when, the next presidential elections?
This is March 2024. So before these elections, this very year, in the end of 2023, he must suggest something to the society as his, let's say, presidential program. Maybe he can suggest kind of a peace plan, or the plan of development of the economy, because we will have some more socio-economic problems right now, more serious than in 2022. And in that sense, it's better for him to stop this war. But this is a normal logic. What is in his brains, we can't understand and explain. And even if he could stop the hot phase of this war, the problems should be continued for domestic audience, for the world, for Russia, for Europe, because he's very bellicose, he's very aggressive, and the problem is in this personalistic rule. And we have to wait for his, let's say, retirement in that sense.
Andrei, what could the democratic forces in the West, also the Ukrainians, do in order to be heard in a stronger way by the Russian public, by Russian citizens, Russian intellectuals?
You know, I can say that there is a understandable receipt how to change the minds of average Russians or advanced classes who are still supporting Putin. I can't find any kind of exit from the situation. But the West can help, pro-democratic, pro-Western Russians. A lot of them are living here, millions of them. And now a lot of them are living somewhere abroad. And I mean different kind of assistance in terms of education for younger generation. I think the West could be more acceptable for Russians who are trying to avoid persecution and who are trying to be more efficient, more useful for their country living abroad. It's also an important part of the story. Not closing borders for all Russians, because Russians with pro-Western brains, as they feel themselves blocked here in Russia. I mean, people who can't leave for some reasons their country.
Andrei Kolesnikov, thank you very much for your insight and for this interview. I wish you all the best in Moscow in the name of everybody here at Bruno Kreisky Forum and from the journalists of Falter. I hope once we'll be able to exchange opinions and experiences in happier times. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for this thought-provoking discussion.
Ich darf mich verabschieden, auch im Namen des Teams im Bruno Kreisky Forum und im Falter. Diskussionen und Gespräche im Kreisky Forum können Sie im Internet nachhören und nachsehen. Ein Abonnement des Falter hält Sie am Laufenden. Bis zur nächsten Sendung.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.